Welcome to Gonkcast, an Autechre podcast. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And this is yet another bonus episode about your emails. Plus, in an effort to prepare ourselves for next week's topic, Warp Tapes 89 to 93, we'll spend some time discussing Oval Moon IBC Mix, an obscure 1991 Autechre track that first appeared on the Warp 20 box set from 2009. I mentioned before that with our main episodes, we'll be working our way chronologically through a bunch of Autechre odds and ends, and we'll try to find neat loosies like Oval Moon for our bi-weekly listener email episodes as well. It seems like every time I go digging, I find some random AE track I've never heard of, so if there's one that you particularly like, be sure to email us and let us know. Gonkcastpod@gmail.com. Actually, it's funny because just the other day, somebody on Twitter was like, @FrauLau, it's spelled just like the track on LSEC 5, tagged us in like this mix that they made. Of all these Lucys, and there were like two that I had never heard of, honestly. So do write us if there's stuff that you're afraid we might miss. Again, next proper episode, we'll be going deep into the 2019 archival mix released as Warp Tapes 89 to 93, and we want to know what you think about it. We haven't gotten very many emails about it yet, actually, and I know it's pretty beloved, so get it together, guys. Gonkcastpod@gmail.com. All right, Dan, what background info do we need to know about Oval Moon IBC Mix?
Back in 2009, Warp Records celebrated their 20th anniversary by releasing a box set called Warp 20. Inside were a few different sets of music, including Warp 20 Chosen, which was a greatest hit selected by fans, and Warp co-founder Steve Beckett. Warp 20 Recreated, which were covers of Warp songs by other Warp artists, and Warp 20 Unheard, a handful of unreleased tracks by some of Warp's biggest artists. Track 3 on that last one is Oval Moon IBC Mix by Autechre, which was recorded back in 1991, the same year as Cavity Job and Lego Feet. The title references IBC Radio, a Manchester pirate radio station where Autechre used to spin records and sneak in their own demos from time to time, so it's safe to assume that a lucky few listeners maybe heard Oval Moon on air back in 1991, but for everyone else, though, it's brand new.
Yeah, so we talked about Cavity Job and Lego Fee when we first started this podcast, and we'll get to spend a lot more time with early Autechre when we talk about the Warp Tapes next week, but I'm curious what you made of this track and what it was like to jump basically from Sign Plus back to 1991.
Yeah, I mean, it was fun to jump back, you know, after going in chronological order, you know, to go back and see, you know, where you came from was pretty cool. As for the track itself, I really liked it, you know. I thought it was honestly better than all of Cavity Job. You know, it's a fun, it's a simple little, you know, just kind of, you know, techno track, but you know, sometimes all you need is that little simplicity. It just really, you know, fun. Nice beat. I like the like delay on the like hi-hats that kind of moves in stereo. You know, just nice little, you know, chord progression. You know, just real simple sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's really like comforting in the way that this kind of like vintage music is. It's funny because I was thinking like it sounds sort of like Boards of Canada in this like warm, warbly kind of vintage way, but like this is literally Boards of Canada. You know, Boards of Canada are like trying to evoke this early era, but this is just literally the early era. And so, but it has that just nice, I don't know, dreamy like warmth to it. Very simple, like you said. It's basically like a four on the floor kick pattern, but there's like this nice kind of snare like dancing all over the top, in this kind of nice pitter patter pattern. And I also do really like the hi-hats, especially like the kind of stretched out, you know, like just cheap old drum machine sounding, like when you stretch out the hi-hat. Yeah, and then just like this nice kind of like, I don't know, two note back and forth, like these two harmonized notes kind of back and forth, making this very simple melody. Some nice leads sort of join in. It actually becomes like this nice kind of kaleidoscopic, you know, web of different melodies and things, despite staying very simple. And, you know, it really just kind of like, it kind of gets rolling. There's like a nice bounce to the bass line and everything. And then it'll kind of like, the drums drop out and you hear some of those like warm synth tones and the drums just come back in. We just do that a couple times for 7 minutes, but it's like nice to live in it for 7 minutes. Like, it's just really a comfy track.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it would have made like a really nice, you know, 12-inch single or something, I think. I mean, better than Cavity Job, for sure, you know? But yeah, I mean, it's very comfy. It's very, I mean, it's just a nice track.
Yeah. I mean, So I'm usually annoyed by this topic, this question, but I've got to ask, do you hear signs of Autechre's like future brilliance or whatever in this track? And like more specifically, does it even sound like Autechre to you at all?
I mean, I think you can like hear the, you know, beginnings of Incunabula or something, you know, that's not that much of a time period jump. But I mean, I think if you're trying to say, you know, I can hear Elsek in there or something. I don't hear it, you know, but I think it's definitely, you know, it shows some promise for at this point an early band, you know, making something so like entrancing and nice, you know, shows that they're probably, you know, worth something.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's not like a huge step back from Incunabula, even though. You know, I was kind of thinking about it, and even like spinning a couple favorite Incunabula tracks just to kind of remind myself. And, you know, there's definitely like a big step up there in sound design. Like there's nothing on Oval Moon that's like, you know, remarkable as a sound in itself. You know what I mean? And Incunabula isn't like totally incredible sound design or anything. But what's funny about it is that there's almost always like some sort of strange sound to it that it's like the rest of the track is built around. You know what I mean? Like even if the drums aren't that crazy, there's like some noise that is, and the drums are built around it, you know? So, but there's just like nothing here that isn't just like a kind of clean synth we've heard lots of times before. You know, nothing wrong with that, but I feel like that's kind of the difference. But I feel like the track design as a whole is kind of similar to Incunabula tracks in the sense that it is kind of like this long, slow ride. I mean, it's still like maybe a little bit dancey, a little club friendly Oval Moon, but you know, so maybe things slow down more and get a little bit more mechanical by the time we get to Incunabula. But it's like, it does have like this kind of like just live in this simplicity for a while, almost like a slow build, because there's, even though it's sort of repetitive, there are like lots of little pings and stuff that sort of join in, little echoes toward the end that just kind of build it in this like very light way. That all kind of screamed Incunabula to me. And actually, like the really simplistic use of melody here, just like those two notes back and forth, and there's like a chord change sometimes, but you know, just the way that they do this kind of all through the 90s, almost like just these really simple but like absolutely hypnotizing melodies. I feel like Oval Moon has that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in listening to this track, it made me want to go back, and I did go back and listen to Incunabula and stuff, you know, because, yeah, I think you're right, you know, what you said about, you know, Incunabula has like it's still, you know, sound design in its infancy, but, you know, it does have like a little bit more of it. This track's definitely, I think if you knew a lot about synths, you know, somebody could probably tell us, you know, what is used on this track, where I, you know, as Autechre goes on, you know, later and later, you know, that becomes harder and harder. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a cool track.
Yeah. And it's funny too, how like the title is that, and like an actually evocative title, like kind of like what a normal electronic artist would do, like an Oval Moon, you know? And
it's
so that was one thing that just struck me jumping from like Sign and Plus back to this. It's like, it's just so funny to see them like trying to capture the mood of the song with the title or something.
Yeah, one thing that was a little strange, speaking of Sign and Plus, the cover of this, you know, Warp compilation, that circle thing in the middle looks exactly like the Sign and Plus circle.
That's a good point. I think it's also designed by the Designers Republic. I got to ponder that a little bit longer. But all right, it sounds like we both feel like this is actually a pretty cool track on its own merits.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I say this every time we talk about some cool Lucy, but there's another reason we need a good compilation, you know, combining all these Autechre tracks.
All right. Well, on that note, let's get into the email, starting with some comments about the Japanese bonus tracks from listener Pokepox. Pokepox notes that they had never heard most of these tracks, so it was kind of interesting to hear your descriptions and then try to imagine what they would sound like. And as I expected, Autechre managed to surprise me anyways. It's just kind of funny to me that somebody was like listening to us without having heard them. They note that NUNR6D, Zexty's Squall, and P1P2 were the most interesting for them. New sounds like a pretty genuine attempt at creating some cavernous atmosphere, quite literally like being lost deep inside a cave as water drips from the ceiling around you and spine-chilling bellows echo your way. Zexty's feels like something that could make more sense specifically in its context of being at the end of Oversteps after the uncompromising madness and chaos of UUP. It feels like hearing Oversteps beaten down to this mangled and tortured mess of noise that's just aimlessly pulsating as if it's trying to exist after being annihilated by its own closing track. P1P2 gives off similar vibes to Shim Ripple Air and Mirage in how desolate and cold it feels, except P1P2 feels more like standing on the undisturbed surface of an alien planet that resembles Earth, but is definitely not earthly. I feel like I'm listening to the hollow wails and croons of some freaky bird-like creatures while standing in the center of a thick forest of plants that look familiar but definitely aren't, and I'm stuck in a state of terror and confusion trying to figure out where I am and if I'm in danger. Mostly just wanted to read all that because we've got so few emails about these tracks for the proper episode, but actually after writing this, we just got another one yesterday as well, so you want to read this one, Dan?
Yeah, it comes from a listener, David, who says, ever since Choristus, I've collected the Japanese edition of Autechre CD releases, so devoted I was to this particular format that I patiently waited for these editions to reach me stateside before hearing the new album, sometimes weeks after most of the AE fan base had absorbed and formulated their own opinions. For me, hearing the album in full with that one bit of extra material made the wait worth it. I love getting the obi strip that hugs the spines of the CDs and the extra printed booklets, even if I can't read the language it's printed in. I find most of these extras are worthwhile, only Zexy's SQL was a bit of a disappointment, but I can't think of what else could follow an epic closer like UUP. My personal favorite is Incur from Sign. It sounds like a fiddle is being played.
Yeah, I mean, again, I just kind of want to read both of these, put them both out there, because we didn't get to read a lot of listener comments in the episode itself, but I wonder if, you know, these just sort of provoke any new reflections on the Japanese bonus tracks for you. I was, you know, sort of taken by David's comment here, which is like, you know, I get if you're a collector, maybe if I was like a big physical media collector, I would also want the Japanese editions, but it's almost as if David is saying like the album is incomplete without the Japanese bonus track. And that sounds kind of crazy at first until you sort of think about like, that's kind of how Autechre treats them, like a little coda or some little, you know what I mean? Like something that sort of fits in with the whole thing. Is that crazy or what? To like, I want to hear the whole thing with the bonus track.
Yeah, I mean, minus those ones in the category of, you know, just live, we're being forced to do this kind of sounding ones. But yeah, like things like Incur and stuff. I don't know if I would say it's complete, you know, it's incomplete without those, especially because, you know, on like Spotify and stuff, they don't put the Japanese track. I wonder if they do, you know, if you access Spotify in Japan, I don't think it comes with that track or anything. I don't know for sure, but you know, I feel like it's like the Japanese bonus track exists for a reason, and I think like you do them because of that reason. It's not really, it doesn't seem to be like 100% because they want to or, you know, anything. So I agree with you, you know, if I collected CDs or something, I would seek them out, but otherwise I think they're just sort of cool little extras that exist.
Yeah, but I do sort of like get what David is saying here, because it's like you think about something like that Zexy's Squall song, it's just like meaningless unless it's following you up almost.
And no, that's true.
Bunch of Japanese bonus tracks where it's like, you know, we were listening to them a little bit in isolation and they just sound like totally underwhelming and random, especially one after the other. But, you know, we were struck by how much care Autechre put into like actually making them fit as the sort of little post-closing piece at the end of the album. So I kind of get that. And I also really liked, I mean, listener Pokebox was kind of on the same tip the way he was describing some of these. But like, I did like those descriptions as well. But all right, let's do some Sign and Plus comments. And I should mention that we held on to these and went straight to the Japanese bonus tracks because I screwed up our schedule and made the Sign Plus episode late. But anyway, what's first, Dan?
Yeah, listener Mitchell says, it's funny that you both said that Sign was the extraterrestrial album and Plus the terrestrial one, because I got the opposite reactions when I first listened to them. When I first listened to M4 Lima, I imagined something like the Stargate from 2001, but as soon as the chord hit, they turned into highway lights during an evening rainstorm. For the rest of the album, I transposed the plot of Vanishing Point to the whole thing. I did agree with the one listener that this is a summer album, but S.I. AI00's low frequency hum and the AU14's propulsive beat made me think of late August, early September afternoons with clear blue skies. Plus, meanwhile, is the soundtrack of taking joyrides in a UFO.
I like this email because I do like sort of agree, even though, you know, we did use like this kind of space, you know, type language to describe a lot of Sign. And I think that fits as well. But like, there's so much about Sign that does make me think of like kind of earthly things. You know, I talked about like a thunderstorm on Arcaz for me. And like some of those kind of propulsive beat tracks do make me think of like driving. I mean, it makes me think of like Blade Runner, but you know, it's still like a city populated by people or something, like, you know what I mean? It's not like
it's on
totally
Earth.
It's not like a totally alien thing, but it's like, you know, there's something about it. But then it's like weird because, okay, I could also understand somebody saying a plus sounds more extraterrestrial to them, and yet it's so like dirty and gritty, you know. It's like, I don't know, I can like agree with both somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's like so fun about these emails and stuff. You know, we always get these fun stories that people think up and everything. And I mean, really, you know, different people have, you know, different reactions to it. And I think that you know, that's a cool thing about just electronic music in general, you know.
Yeah.
It's can evoke like different, you know, emotions in different people and stuff.
Yeah. I just, you know, I was just kind of struck by that email because I really felt that way sometimes on several Sign tracks, but then it was like, as a whole, I felt like I was in space for some reason. All right, here's more from listener Mitchell, who says, Sign might be album 14, but Plus is EP 12. This was the first album of theirs that I felt underwhelmed by because it felt like a collection of B-sides instead of a cohesive album. Definitely a weaker take on what Sickly Sweet and Move of 10 did. However, Marhide is the notable exception because it reminded me of waiting for the subway while someone's boombox is playing in the side. Still, I can remember how it went, so that makes it better than Draft 730. This got me wondering... Is Marhide actually good because it's so memorable?
Just because a song's memorable doesn't make it good. I mean, I know most of the words to Bop still, you know, that doesn't mean
song.
It.
Honestly,
that,
it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Song.
Yeah. Maybe a bad example, but, but you know what I mean? There's plenty of shitty songs, that, you know, the words to or are memorable. If a song's annoying, it tends to get stuck in your head quicker than if it's good, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that Marhide is shitty or anything. It's definitely like the divisive one on that record. But yeah, I don't think just because it's it stands out, not like in, you know, oh, it's the definitely best track. It's just it's the most memorable because of 808, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean that, but also like it sounds so lazy and it sounds so like shitty, almost like just how, you know, just the balls to like make a quote-unquote hook out of just escalating layers of kiss, you know. There's something just like it's so weird that it's memorable, but it's just, I was just thinking about this email because I was like, okay, if I was gonna rank every song on Plus, I would probably put Marhide like, you know, sort of in the middle, because I barely remember like I pre-esque, you know, like I couldn't tell you which, you know, I could probably come up with all three of these little Sign type ambient tracks, but I don't know which is which necessarily off the top of my head, but like Marhide, I know. So it's like, for some reason I feel compelled to be like, well, then I guess the more successful track.
Yeah, but again, you know, just because it sticks out, you know, like that last shitty Modest Mouse album, I only remember that song Pistol, because it was the worst song on that record. Like, by every other song was really bad, and that one was god awful. And that doesn't mean it was, you know, the best song because I remember it. You know what I mean?
True. All right, what's next?
All right, next we've got one from listener Ella, who says, I adore both Sign and Plus. Our Cats is one of the best ambient tracks they've done, and Ecol 4 and X4 are highlights of their career. On the other hand, Psin AM is one of the weakest tracks Odd-Tekker have done, and having it right after the Red A makes it even worse in my eyes. Not because I don't like the Red A, it's just that having two of the most minimal tracks in a row screws with the pacing. It's just a boring synth, another boring synth, and a boring kick drum that goes away around the middle and then comes back for no reason. Also, 7FMIC is the most underrated track on both. I love the wonky beat and almost lasery synth work. It's a real how the fuck moment in a discography full of how the fuck moments.
I mostly just wanted to read this to not defend, but just sort of share my perspective on Sin AM a little bit more, which is like, I didn't mention this on the episode, I don't think, but I definitely wrote it down in my notes, which is like, I love that moment when the beat drops out and all of a sudden you kind of like realize how generic the track is. And then the beat returns and it's just like this glorious, like I said, like riding on a motorcycle through the Blade Runner city or whatever kind of moment for me. Like, it's very simple. It's like the most kind of like, I think we compared it to Gas, other listeners compared it to Boards of Canada or whatever, but it's like, it's one of the more like another artist than Autechre could have done this tracks in Autechre's discography. And yet there's something, and particularly about that moment when the beat leaves and then returns, that just like hits me like right in the right spot somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that.
Any other sort of comments? I guess we maybe gushed about all these tracks enough, but, you're a big 7FM fan, right?
Yeah, yeah, I like it. You know, I agree with the listener. I think it is pretty underrated. I can't remember if I picked that as one I, you know, thought would be higher when we did the, you know, best tracks from Rate Your Music or whatnot. But yeah, I definitely agree that that one's underrated.
Well, listener Ella also recommended this visualization of Garbage Mix made by a YouTuber, Anatomy of a Track. I'll link it in the show notes. Plus, Ella shared this fan-made compilation called LSEC 6 through 10, but I think we'll save that for another episode. But what did you think of that Garbage Mix video?
It was cool, you know, how it like... It's a good way to like visualize the way the beat is structured, you know, with the yeah. weird time signature or whatever. You know, I don't, if you were like really interested in that kind of thing and you wanted to, you know, dissect it and maybe, you know, see how it's done, I could see it being interesting for the whole time. But, you know, I got the point quickly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you're kind of like just almost traveling down this dark tunnel or something in the video. And then there's like different lights are almost like coming on with the different parts of the beat. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes you appreciate like just how intricate, you know, Garbage Mix is. And it's funny because we were just talking about like Oval Moon, right? Which isn't nearly as intricate as Garbage Mix, but it just makes you, you know, you could do this with Oval Moon as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because by the end of the track, there are a lot of interlocking parts. And it's just so funny because I was sort of thinking about, you know, I think we talked about this on the podcast before, but it's like I used to, when we were doing early Autechre releases, I would like write down notes about every part of the track, you know, what it's doing. And that becomes impossible by the time you get to like sort of the mid to later period of Autechre. And so you could just like never make a video like this about, you know, an LSEC track or something, because it just doesn't even make sense like to divide it into parts. You couldn't even do it. But there's something about this video that just sort of made me remember how intricate and like just brilliantly crafted their earlier music was.
Yeah, I think it is like a really good way to visualize that, especially if somebody, you know, doesn't have any like experience like working with electronic music or anything, like to really see it, you know, visualized. How many different parts are going along at once, it, you know, is pretty nice.
Yeah, because it's easy to let it just wash over you, but actually,
yeah, exactly.
You know, you can focus in on these little things. Again, I'll sort of link it in the show notes. Now, listener Dan wrote in to say that he often thinks about Sign and Plus in relation to another 2020 album, Bob Dylan's Rough and Rowdy Ways. He writes, both seem to directly or indirectly hint at confronting mortality and maybe even the slight dangers of forced introspection. I also think on both albums there are some career highlights, and just like Dylan, how is it that being this deep into a career, can you keep having something to say? You're the, you know, sort of Bob Dylan fanatic or resident Bob Dylan fanatic, Dan. So what do you think about that comparison?
I think that the confronting mortality thing kind of gets shoehorned into Rough and Rowdy Ways because when he released it, he was 79 years old. you know, so it's sort of like, you know, it's like how Black Star, you know, once Bowie died, everybody like realized, you know, there was this whole mortality thing to it. I feel like everybody's just sort of since Black Star, you know, shoehorning that into any old guy that releases something. But I mean, you know, I think too, I feel like if you are 79 years old writing music, it would be hard to not think about your mortality. So I'm sure it's creeped in at some point. As for mortality and Sign and Plus, I don't I don't know. It's hard to say with something instrumental, you know, like we were just talking about a few minutes ago, with Autechre and just instrumental music in general, it's sort of easy for people to make their own stories and, you know, shoehorn something in there.
Yeah. And if like Rough and Rowdy Ways was on your mind, then you might
exactly
affix that to
something. Exactly.
But they're not 79, obviously, Robin Shaw.
No, yeah, exactly. That's the other thing, you know, being deep in the career and still having something to say. I mean, it's definitely impressive with Autechre, but they're, you know, 31 years into the career, where, you know, Dylan's 60 years into a career. So I think, yeah, I think it's a little different.
I mean, it's still impressive, but it's like, for me, it's like with Autechre, they have never like stopped being innovative and interesting. So when I listen to Cyan and Plus, maybe there are people who like got turned off by some of the 2010s work or something. And for them, Cyan was like this kind of like melodic, kind of like plaintive, nostalgic kind of thing, and feels like that kind of looking back thing. But, you know, for me, it's just like Autechre don't really need to do that. Like, you know, Bob Dylan has released a lot of shitty albums. And so it's just like when he kind of comes out with a stunner like this, it's like, wow, he really like summoned something, you know, some of his old magic. And now he's like kind of using it to reflect back on his career and all that stuff that like writers like to say. But, you know, I guess the short version is I wouldn't fault somebody for hearing that in Cyan and Plus, but I just don't, because I don't feel like they have anything to like. They're not the reflective types. They've been like pushing forward all the time, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you're right. I mean, also Autechre, I mean, basically been good for 30 years for, you know, Dylan doesn't have a 30-year stretch where he wasn't releasing shit.
Not many people have a 30-year stretch like Autechre.
No, that's true. That's definitely true.
All right, what's next?
All right, from listener Darren, they say, I had a couple of thoughts. Firstly, about the Cyan artwork. I was surprised no one mentioned the circles being the same AE blobs from the 1/6 tour posters overlapping in layers. I thought your analysis of empty space from the design was spot on, as the negative space left from the blobs created the patterns inside the rings. So I'm guessing there has to be some connection between these records and the 1/6 material.
Yeah, we didn't. I don't know how we didn't mention this, but like, you know, it seems pretty clear that the sort of 1/6 artwork has this, you know, this kind of circular shapes and these different shadings and stuff. And, you know, in the little color circle on Cyan and Plus, you can, I think, see that those same kind of shapes like overlaid on each other. Is that how you see it?
Yeah. I see it for sure. Yeah.
And of course, like the negative space part is like almost the same shape from the tour poster that kind of makes this almost A looking shape. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I tried to think of like some deep thing to say about this, but maybe it just gives the impression that like Cyan and Plus are somehow like kind of a product of the experimentation that was going on 1/6. Do you have any other sort of theories, deep theories or anything like that?
No, I was thinking about it too. Because I really don't think that, you know, it sounds like, you know, straight out of 1/6 or anything, but yeah, I think what you just said could be correct. You know, it's born from that experimentation.
Well, Darren also writes, Rob mentioned in an interview that sign was actually an acronym, but wasn't going to reveal the meaning. Any guesses on what sign might stand for? We talked about this on our initial reactions episode, and I kind of hesitated to bring it up on our main episode again, because I just literally have no idea. But have you had any new revelations about what sign might stand for?
No, because I think like if sign stands for something, you know, it's written in all caps, then I think that implies that plus also has to stand for something. Yeah. And at that point, I think they're just fucking with us, and it probably doesn't neither one stands for anything. Or if it does, it's some thing we wouldn't understand, like the you know, track titles, you know, it means something about their system or something, you know.
I know, that's what that was like my guess, is like if it stands for something, it's probably like something stupid like gear nerdy, like stereo input gain knob. I know that doesn't start with an M, but you know what I mean. But
like, yeah.
It's like something like that.
It would be disappointing. It would be disappointing to learn, you know.
But it would be bizarre if it was like some like line of poetry that they act, you know, it would be like going back to the Oval Moon days of like some evocative title that they turned into an acronym. Doesn't seem like them.
Yeah. I think it's either a joke or it means like nothing to the average person. Well, another proper popular sign plus theory from listener Nathan, who writes, Rob and Sean have said in interviews that they will each work on a track individually and then send it to the other, and sometimes there are no edits the other makes. They said their friends could easily distinguish who made which tracks. I have a sneaking suspicion that Sean made Sign and Rob made Plus. They may have used some of the same core pieces of the system for tracks such as F7 from Sign and 7FMIC from Plus. Tweaking parameters and sounds and tempos could cause these tracks to have more in common than first listens would hint at. We will probably never know if there's any validity to this theory, but it's fun to ponder.
Yeah, I hear this, you know, pretty often, like what are maybe their solo albums or something like that. And I get the inclination to feel that way with like Sign, because it feels so minimal, you know. It's like who like you couldn't have like added something or whatever. But they have said that in interviews, that sometimes that happens where they just send something and like the other one doesn't even touch it. But they've also said that they send something and then the other one like completely fucks it up to where it like doesn't even resemble, like the other one doesn't even realize that it's the thing that they originally sent. You know, I'm just inclined to believe them in the interviews we were reading on the episode last week, where it's like they were working independently and realized they were like kind of in a similar headspace for some of the tracks. You know what I mean? And like, probably traded back and forth. Maybe there was less editing than usual or something. Maybe some things just fit right together. But I really feel like Sign is a combination. Like, I feel like that's what was exciting to them, was realizing, hey, we're both kind of making music that's kind of in a similar vein. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, this theory arises because it's two different records, you know, that come out at the same time, have similar covers. It's the first time they've sort of done this, and it one not be designated as an EP. So it does like sort of, you know, reek of that a little bit, like you know, that Outkast record, like Speaker yeah. Box and Love Below or something. But you know, it just seems like Odd Tucker seems, I mean, of course, I don't actually know, but it just seems like such a collaborative effort that they wouldn't do that, you know? Or if they did, you know, they would just make a solo record, you know, each on their own or something, you know? It just doesn't, I don't know. I don't tend to believe it. I don't really have any, you know, proof either way, I guess, but it just doesn't seem like, I think, like you said, I just tend to believe those interviews.
Yeah, it just seems very unlikely that like they were like working on stuff separately, and you know, Sean made this like very cohesive, kind of like ambient, like Vangelis sounding kind of album, and then Rob made this random hodgepodge with three tracks that sound just like Sean's album. You know, like it just makes perfect sense what they said in the interview we were reading last time, which is like, they put stuff together for Sign, and there were all these little like loose ends that kind of ended up forming into Plus. I just sort of believe that. But all right, shifting into a few more random questions. Listener Drew asks, which member of Odd Tucker do you think is hotter, and why is the correct answer Rob? These are the hard-hitting questions I like. I agree. I mean, I feel like objectively Rob is the more handsome one. I asked my wife, and she said she also agreed. I think Sean is more of an acquired taste, certainly a good looking dude. I don't mean to besmirch him, but what do you think?
I mean, Sean's shorter. I'm a shorter guy, so I tend to, you know, go with that. So I would say Sean. Also, he always looks like a badass in pictures. You know, he's like smoking. I like the bad boys.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I feel like Rob looks like kind of a regular bloke. You wouldn't guess if you saw him that he's like in a weird experimental...
No, but Sean, you're like, that guy's into some cool stuff.
I see it. Yeah. All right, well, Drew continues, okay, to be slightly more serious, how has your overall view of the discography changed as you've done the podcast? I imagine you're planning on contrasting the first look episodes on Sign and Plus with the view you have on them now. I think we did do a little bit of that. And one of these days we'll do like a proper reassessment episode where we'll finalize our album ranks, do some larger reflection, maybe some like superlatives type stuff I've got in mind. But I thought we could get the creative juices flowing by just touching on this question. Now, any big changes in your AE outlook come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, there were some albums that I, you know, surprised me with how much I liked them, and you know, some that I thought I, you know, didn't like as much, and you know, stayed that way. I I think the biggest thing was listening to it in order. You know, I had never like sat down and done that, and just hearing, you know, how much they really change. You know, I mean, because I basically got into Autechre through Tri Repete, you know, and listened to that and Amber and stuff like that. But then, you know, I didn't start like actively following them and you know, checking out new records until like XI. You know, so I sort of like missed that middle gap.
Yeah, and I feel you used to kind of think that that was like sort of a darker period or like good period as a whole, but we actually kind of both agree that they're are a bunch of like stunners in there.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was my biggest, you know, takeaway was learning that there never really was a dark period. Cause even those records that I, you know, am not the fondest of, I still always like enjoy them. You know, there's not a single thing we've listened to except maybe Cavity Job, that I like didn't enjoy at least somewhat. I mean, even Cavity Job, it's not like I didn't hate, you know, it's not like, oh my God. Gotta listen to this, you know. It just wasn't as good, you know.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like the things that come to mind are like things I've actually probably said on the podcast a bunch of times by now. But it's like I used to think of Autechre as kind of making this like straight line forward all the time. Like each album is like a new step forward, and I actually kind of realized that there's like a lot of zigzagging and a lot of albums. Like honestly, I feel like this is their main MO. The album is just like a direct reaction against the previous album, like just to like do the opposite of what they just did. So it's like hard to say, you know, that like, you know, because Untilted is like almost like weirdly retro in its like drum programming and like this the sound of the drums and stuff, and like just kind of the beat heavy, like almost, you know, danceable quote unquote nature of it. You know, it's not like a step forward. It's really just a reaction against the sort of Confield draft era. It's like, let's do something totally different from what we've been doing. So I came to sort of appreciate that it's not just a straight trajectory. And also on that note, what I was just saying, it's like, I never really realized how much sort of nostalgia there is in Autechre. I feel like I was just sort of surprised to realize like how many times I felt like albums or songs were sort of doing this kind of like affection for acid or affection for techno or like affection for the idea of drum machine, you know, as late as like NTS. I feel like the NTS one has a lot of like stuff that just feels like really tapped into their like early hip hop roots, those b-boy roots, you know what I mean? So those are the two things that really surprised me most.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, to that I you know, I didn't really realize that either until you spend so much time with, you know, I sort of always thought like, oh, you know, once XI hits, it's just absolutely mental, you know, it's of some other world, and we never touch Earth again.
Yeah,
but really there really is a lot of you know, that nostalgia and stuff just done up in such a way that I think it's not like very obvious on first listen. All right, well, next email, listener Tron wrote in to complain about the track TBM2 from LSEC 3. He writes, between the epic beatless dronescape of Easter and the absolutely mental twisted metallic workout of Mesh Cinereal, they've managed to place this little thing within just a few bars. Makes me hear Freddie fucking Mercury going, we will rock you. It drives me crazy, obviously, and I wonder if I'm the only one that's having this problem. Now that I've put this out there, hopefully it will haunt someone else for a change.
I don't know if we mentioned this on the episode, but I definitely wrote it in my notes that like, why is that kind of stomp stomp clap from that Queen song all of a sudden appearing in the middle of LSEC 3? it's sort of undeniable to me. Like it was the first thing I thought of, and you know, we sort of complained about this track, like how random and just like weirdly intrusive it feels, just like in between these two tracks that Tron was describing, like these two absolute epics, like honestly highlights of the whole project, and there's just like this little stomp stomp clap thing in the middle for like 5 minutes. Feels very pointless, and I guess if you can't get the Queen comparison out of your head, then like could even be annoying. Did you make this connection as well?
No, I didn't think about it until this, you know, email, but I think officially the stomp stomp clap should be retired, you know, because it's that song has just you know how you can get sued for using the, you know, the same chords as another song or something. The same thing with the stomp stomp clap.
Yeah, and it's just so funny because it actually is like a clap sound. So it's like really makes you think of, you know, like,
yeah, actually, yeah, exactly.
You know, like people like at sporting events stomp on the ground and then clap. They should have used the like Be My Baby beat if they wanted to use a real typical beat, you know, like the boom, 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 clap, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, that yeah, been yeah.
All right. Well, listener Trond also recommended that we cover Stereolab next, and I just wanted to give you a rundown of recent artist recommendations. Listener Jordan recommended Earth, Boris, Arca, Biosphere, Tim Hecker, The Body, Mogwai, and honestly a ton more that I think he half-jokingly copied from some list somewhere. Listener Wendell recommended Pansonic, The Magnetic Fields, Justin Broadrick, though he admits it's ridiculous in scope, that discography, so maybe he should just find a friend and do it. And to that I say you totally, totally should. He also recommends Bjork, Tortoise, and Boards of Canada, adding, I'd enjoy you two doing Boards of Canada since I can trust you not to get silly fanboy about it trying to figure out hidden messages in backmasked vocal samples or whatever. I find that stuff tiresome and only useful in that it contributes to the vibe of a track. Y'all will actually talk about the music. Any reactions to any of these? Any new recommendations pique your interest at all?
I mean, Boards of Canada would be fun, you know, because there is so much to dig in. And it's, you know, I think if you're a fan of Autechre, you're probably a fan of Boards of Canada.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it would kind of suck to pick a band that's only going to last, you know, a couple more weeks. And then, you know, we'd have to pick another one.
Yeah. But I like this email, though, because it was like my hesitation with Boards of Canada and like Aphex Twin also is like, it's probably already been done. You know, it's probably already out there somewhere.
Yeah, there probably is one. You're right.
And I want to add something new to the conversation, but what Trond is saying here is like maybe our approach to Boards of Canada would be new, you know, in that we're not like trying to interpret backwards vocals, you know, devil talk, backwards devil talk or anything like that. So that makes me a little bit more interested in doing that because then it's like, you know, we would actually be adding something new to the conversation, which is important to me. I also, I you know, getting into a little bit outside the electronic realm, but still tied into it. Stereolab, I fucking love Bjork. I fucking love Tortoise sounds fun as well. I don't know. Any other reactions?
I know you love Stereolab, but I was trying to listen to something the other day. I just can never love it. So I don't know if I would want to do a podcast, yeah. But I can never get past like that album was okay.
Interesting. Well, we'll continue thinking about it and definitely report back. Although again, we have tons more Autechre to cover, but what's the next email?
Yeah, from listener Steve says, after seeing the AE Twitch recordings, which claimed to be Sean running various video recordings through Max MSP, it made me wonder if portions of LSEC, AE Live, and NTS could be this, or at least have originated from them running some sort of signal through their patches and scripts that would help examine how they are able to produce so many long tracks that are constantly changing because they are relying on a non-audio import source like a video recording. Who knows, but it's neat to think about.
Yeah, I saw this post on the Autechre subreddit sort of recently. I want to credit the author, Yu Tuck-Amak, who kind of summarized this like weird little AETV era where I guess Sean was just like dicking around on Twitch. Maybe I'll either link I'll just link this post because there's a bunch of links in here to like videos and stuff that you can check out for yourself. But I'll put that in the show notes. But like, for example, there's this like, you know, Deco Lock engine. I'm not smart enough to understand what this means, but it's like there's basically like a video on YouTube. It's just like 6 hours of Decolock just like kind of auto generating. It's like there's a video running and it's just messing up Decolock. You can hear the sounds from it, that great track from XI, but it's like getting totally messed up presumably by the video input. And you know, it's really haunted. Like, it'll really give you nightmares, this video. But it's like, I feel like it's an interesting thought because sometimes you feel like, God, how are they programming this kind of like what sounds like random, you know, generative stuff? Like when everybody else is trying to make like generative algorithmic stuff, it sounds really shitty and like trite and just like predictable, you know? And I wonder, like, what if there is some sort of like weird non-audio input that is affecting the track? And that's what's making like some of these absolutely crazy, unpredictable changes. Does that sound possible to you?
I know very, very little to nothing about video.
Yeah.
So I think I just have to say I'm not smart enough. I don't know enough about it. But I mean, you know, that Deco Lock video is certainly evidence that it's possible. So it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, you know, they don't seem like people who would say, oh, you know, we can't use, you know, video to mess with the music. You know, they seem open to any sort of, you know, technology or idea. So, you know, I definitely could see it, assuming it's possible.
Yeah, it's I don't know. This email was just like very intriguing to me, and that Reddit post, because it seems like very possible to me, actually. Like, I never really thought about it before, but if they're like, some external thing is affecting the track, that might explain some of the insanity, even though I'm sure they're not doing this all the time, but maybe they do it sometimes as an experiment.
Yeah, and I think it's in that Reddit post. Like, one of the things he did was like play Sonic the Hedgehog like with Max, I don't understand how that at all is a thing. Like, I don't know how you would do that.
I don't understand either. I really don't even understand. I don't know if like what I'm saying right now even makes any sense at all, but like I feel like they're it feels like there's something there that they might be feeding something into some of their engines, quote unquote. I feel like it's totally possible. But all right, that's it for the emails. And lastly, you know, a couple of listeners, like listener Joe, listener Mitchell, and at least a few others whose emails I've somehow misplaced, wrote in to congratulate me for getting married a few months ago during the course of this podcast. Wow, we've gone through so much together on this podcast. I just want to say thank you for that. It's really kind to write in with that. Dan gets no congratulations because he got married a long time ago.
Yeah. Fuck me, I guess. But if you've got any odd Tucker opinions or hot takes or, you know, compliments you'd like to give me, we want to hear them. GonkCastPod@gmail.com. Next episode in a week, going to be the Warp Tapes. Again, send us your thoughts. GonkCastPod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out by subscribing and leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Look us up YouTube, stay connected, Twitter, Instagram. Both those are @GonkCastPod. And we'll see you next time.
See ya.